Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up today on the program, our correspondent in Beijing will join us to shed some light on China's new leadership. A leaked report from the United Nations says the organization failed to protect civilians in Sri Lanka. Also, the UN exiting East Timor. Many are worried that this will raise unemployment. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. On Thursday, all eyes were on Beijing, as it announced Xi Jinping will take over the top job of the Chinese Communist Party. Before he said a few words himself, he introduced the new members of the Standing Committee.
The plenary meeting elected 7 members of the Standing Committee of the Political Bureau and elected me as the General Secretary of the CPC Central Committee. Here, let me present to you my 6 colleagues who have also been elected as members of the Standing Committee of the Political Bureau.
他们是李克强同志。
They are Comrade Li Keqiang,
Zhang Dejiang同志,
Comrade Zhang Dejiang,
Yu Zhengsheng同志,
Comrade Yu Zhengsheng,
Liu Yunshan同志,
Comrade Liu Yunshan,
Wang Qishan同志,
Comrade Wang Qishan,
Zhang Gaoli同志,
and Comrade Zhang Gaoli.
Xi Jinping introducing the new members of China's Standing Committee of the Communist Party of China. He then said a few words of thanks to the members of the Communist Party and some words of encouragement to move ahead.
Here, on behalf of the new central leadership, I wish to sincerely thank the whole party for the trust you have placed in us. We shall do everything we can to live up to your trust and fulfill our mission. The party membership's trust and the whole nation's expectation are a source of tremendous encouragement for us and put enormous responsibility on our shoulders. It is a major responsibility we owe to the nation. Ours is a great nation. Throughout 5 millennia of our civilization and progress, the Chinese nation has made an indelible contribution to human progress. During the modern period, our nation has undergone many trials and tribulations and faced its gravest hour. Since then, numerous Chinese patriots have waged hard struggles for the sake of the great renewal of the Chinese nation. But time and again, they have failed. At that point, the Communist Party of China was founded. It has rallied and led the people in stepping into the breach and making tenacious efforts to turn the poor and backward old China into a new China, ever closer to the goal of national prosperity and strength. The great renewal of the Chinese nation has thus embraced a bright prospect never seen before.
Xi Jinping. To have a more in-depth look at the power transfer, we're now joined by our Beijing correspondent, Jocelyn Ford. Now, Jocelyn, it's been a long time that people already suspected that Xi Jinping would take over the reins. But saying that, were there any surprises?
They did, but there was, you know, some question marks until the very last minute whether they really would pare down the top leadership to 7 positions or leave it at 9. And so, you know, that wasn't known, so to speak. I wouldn't say there are any big surprises, but one of the things that some of the folks who'd been hoping for more reform, political reform, broader, more anti-corruption, were disappointed that 2 people who were seen as leading reformers did not make it into the top 7. So that was something.
Now, if we look at the top 7, how would you describe this top 7? Were they chosen because they're going to play it safe?
Well, let me say this, first of all. I was here 10 years ago when Hu Jintao came in, and I tell you, his speech was, you know, you couldn't tell what the guy was thinking. You felt like he had a huge, great wall built around him to close him off from the world. And it was sort of a breath of fresh air today when Xi Jinping came in, and he just seemed like an ordinary guy that you could actually relate to. He seems comfortable in his skin. He seems like he might be a leader who would get along with leaders from other countries. So that was sort of something pleasant, which I felt when just watching him speak. He didn't do a lot of slogans. He actually chatted a lot longer than Hu Jintao did 10 years ago when he came to power. So that was nice. Then you had the rest of the usual show and tell of these guys all in the dark suits, standing very stiffly, you know, and you didn't get much of a feeling for the other personalities, but that's sort of par for the course for the China's Communist Party.
Now, with this happening, is there any speculation yet on what could be expected? Because Hu Jintao is actually leaving as president of China next year, early next year, and that position will be taken over by Xi Jinping. So, of course, in the next few months, there's not going to be any type of major transformation in either domestic policy or foreign policy. But are people already speculating now that there could be some changes in these areas?
Well, you know, consistency, more policy, the same as usual. The Chinese Communist Party is usually run by consensus. These are all sort of the old tunes that one tends to hear. I actually, personally, I'm more of I think the personality of the top leadership does matter. And if you look deep into the backgrounds of the seven people, two of them are quite, shall we say, conservative, keep a lid on the country, not don't reform too quickly, please. One of them is Liu Yunshan, who's part of the censorship apparatus. And so, you know, that's why some people aren't feeling terribly encouraged. However, when you look into their backgrounds, a number of them, I believe I counted three, had actually been brought in to clean up crises when other politicians had problems. Either one with SARS didn't handle SARS very well. Other corruption, sort of anti-corruption. So there is some sort of hope that there could be a stronger anti-corruption move on the part of this cabinet. One thing, Wang Qishan, he is a very strong economics leader. He is supposedly going to be put in charge of fighting corruption. He's a former banker. He knows the industry. He probably knows how it works. And the word among Chinese is that since he has no kids, he's the perfect guy to fight corruption because it's usually the families that are involved. So anyway, we'll see where that heads. But I find this rather intriguing.
Now, of course, you were talking about corruption. And I mean, there was a lot of talk about, you know, cracking down on corruption. This is China's future. We have to crack down on corruption. But this seems like the same record that's being played over and over. It's not the first time that we've heard this.
That's absolutely true. And it certainly won't be the last time we've heard it. So the question will be, what sort of action will you see? I think there's some road signs out there to look for. One is, you know, is the media going to be given any more leeway? Because the media has been key, and especially what's going on the internet, on the way China's Twitter, the Weibo, they've outed a lot of corrupt officials, and that's become sort of a watchdog. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with media under this new top leadership. I think it'll be interesting to see how Bo Xilai, the guy who was going to be in the top leadership, but his wife was involved with the murder of a British guy, and he has been kicked out of the party. It'll be interesting to see how his case is cleaned up. Now, I wouldn't expect any major changes, and people expect a show trial, you know, could very well be a show trial without a lot of facts coming out. But that would be another key thing to look for, because one thing of interest is that Xi Jinping and presumably the next prime minister, Li Keqiang, both have some sort of legal background. And this is the first time that you will have people with a strong legal background taking over the government. So the question is, will the judicial system be given any more independence from the Communist Party, which is sort of a key to cracking down on corruption? So these are some of the things to look for.
But, you know, other experts that I've spoken to, Jocelyn, they say the problem with cracking down on corruption in China is that, okay, Beijing may have a strategy in place and they want to really get rid of corruption with, you know, not just within the Communist Party, but in all different sectors of Chinese society and also in commerce as well. But when it comes to, let's say, the provinces, you know, how much is Beijing willing to pressure the provinces where there is a tremendous amount of corruption, but also Beijing gets a lot of their support from the regions and the provinces? How willing do you think these leaders are to really go after the problem?
Well, one thing is willingness and the other thing is ability. And as you've said, it's a huge country and there's a lot of independent-minded people out in the provinces, and it's just hard to, enforce whatever rules or regulations they may put in place. So this is a big, you know, a big tough nut. But if it gets, you know, too bad, the thing is this, is that the government is more sensitive to public opinion than certainly it was 10 years ago, for example. You're hearing a lot more voices. If this gets too out of hand, there is a certain amount of nervousness that, you know, they could lose a grip on the country. So if they feel pressured by the public to take more action, it may be just for show, but we could see a little bit more in this direction. I wouldn't be too hopeful, though.
Now let's talk about foreign policy for a moment. I mean, we've seen that the United States is expanding their reach in Asia. They've just built a military complex in the northern tip of Australia. There's also the conflict with Korea, and there's reports coming out that this past week, and in the past few weeks, in fact, North Korea has been testing new rockets. Do you think that with this new leadership change, because the personalities are very different, they may take, let's say, a harder line on North Korea, and also maybe a harder line on the United States expanding its reach in Asia?
I think, anything is possible if the new leadership feels they have to prove themselves being tough on other countries, you know, is a way to go. But as I was saying, I mean, Xi Jinping is much more internationally minded than Hu Jintao was. From everything I've heard, Hu Jintao just was not comfortable meeting foreigners. He would avoid it at all costs. If he absolutely had to, he would. And Xi Jinping isn't like that. He's dealt with a lot of foreign businesses in his earlier posts as in some of the coastal provinces with the booming economies. He spent some time in the U.S. He's made six trips there. He, you know, was famous for being in Iowa. He's sort of a populist in the sense that he has hobbies and a personality. So if he leverages that, I'd like to hold out a vague hope that he could help improve international relations because foreign leaders may be able to identify with him. So that's one thing. And North Korea, it's of interest that one of the seven, Jang Dejang, is actually studied in North Korea. Worked up near the border there. So it'll be interesting to see whether his ties that go back way back when, how they play out.
That was Jocelyn Ford, our China correspondent, joining us on the line from Beijing. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A leaked draft report on the United Nations' role in the last months of the Sri Lankan civil war in 2009 says the organization failed its mandate to protect civilians. In an all-out effort over several months, the Sri Lankan army wiped out the last of the Tamil Tigers amid massive civilian losses. The win bolstered the government, which still today continues to deny its shared responsibility for the tens of thousands of civilian deaths. The internal UN review concludes the events in Sri Lanka marked a grave failure of the UN to provide assistance and to inform the world. We have this report from Karen Snowden.
Sri Lanka's civil war raged for almost three decades, and both sides were responsible for serious human rights abuses. In early 2009, the army had the last few thousand Tamil Tigers surrounded in a small area in the country's northeast. But trapped with them were 360,000 civilians. Over a period of several months, at least 40,000 civilians are thought to have died, partly through the actions of the Sri Lankan army and government. In May 2009, UN manager in Colombo, Gordon Weiss, accused both sides of killing civilians and tried to alert the world to the carnage.
The UN has documented more than 700 children who have been killed throughout the conflict in the last few months. It is in keeping with a warning that we have been issuing for many weeks now about a bloodbath should the warring parties not restrain themselves sufficiently at this stage of the conflict.
So you're calling this a bloodbath?
Yes, we are.
No longer with the UN and speaking from New York, Gordon Weiss says the UN didn't do enough.
It's a huge failure. It's a failure on a personal level and on an institutional level. I think that there were people who failed to realise that their primary responsibility was to protect human life, and the consequence was that we probably didn't do as much as we could have done in that time.
Radio Australia has seen a copy of the unsigned draft Petrie report, which it's thought the Secretary General will release by the end of this week. It's a damning assessment of what the report calls the grave failure of the UN to respond to the crisis. It's critical of some, but not all, senior UN staff in Colombo at the time who didn't see the prevention of the killing of civilians as their responsibility, and of UN member states for ignoring the human rights disaster. It says UN decision-making at all levels was dominated by a culture of trade-offs and a failure to confront the government's deliberate obstructions to allow humanitarian assistance. Sri Lanka's High Commissioner to Australia, Admiral Tisara Samarasinghe, told Brendan Trembath the UN left the war zone for safety reasons.
There was no requirement for eyes and ears to independently monitor. The Sri Lankan government was fighting a ruthless terrorist organization. In spite of that, Sri Lankan government, with the help of the International Committee of Red Cross, maintained the supply lines of food, medicine and fuel to the conflict areas. They are witnesses to the effort the government took.
Dr. Sam Parry is spokesperson for the Australian Tamil Congress.
The UN silence, in essence, allowed the Sri Lankan regime to conduct the genocidal campaign against the Tamil people. The UN now has a chance to redeem itself by giving the Tamil people, it had once failed, the justice that they deserve by ensuring an international independent investigation into war crimes, but also through the restoration of Tamil sovereignty post-genocide, as was in the case with nations such as Kosovo.
Former UN staffer Gordon Weiss has recently published a book, The Cage, which tells the story of the end of the war and backgrounds the long and bloody Tamil separatist struggle. He places much of the blame for the UN's failure at the top and the disinterest of the Security Council. In his book, he noted China played a prominent role in the Security Council in blocking debate on Sri Lanka.
The leading member states failed to sit down and seriously consider what appears to have been crimes against humanity and war crimes in Sri Lanka during this period, but there is certainly culpability spread throughout the organisation.
Now, you've been working with a group established in Sydney, gathering statements and evidence to be used in, you hope, an independent war crimes tribunal. How's that proceeding?
The International Crimes Evidence Project is compiling a brief of evidence which is due to be handed to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in December. And we expect that this brief of evidence will be very influential in pushing forward consideration of what indeed did happen, bearing in mind that the government of Sri Lanka has consistently said that it was responsible for no deaths and no killings at the end of the war, and that if anybody died, it was the result of the actions of the Tamil Tigers. So the question is a very open one. How did these tens of thousands of people die?
That was Karen Snowden reporting. Hundreds of East Timorese will be forced to find new jobs when the United Nations withdraws from the country at the end of this year. 900 East Timorese are directly employed by the United Nations peacekeeping mission, and they'll be out of work. And a further 1,300 security guards employed by a private firm contracted by the UN. Acting Chief of Staff for the UN mission, Gary Gray, says while the impact will be noticeable, the UN has been preparing staff for the transition for a long time. We have this story from Stephanie March.
When the United Nations mission leaves at the end of the year, it takes with it some sought-after jobs. 900 Timorese directly employed by the mission will be out of work. A further 1,300 security guards employed by a private firm contracted by the UN will also need to be deployed elsewhere. Gary Gray is the acting chief of staff for the United Nations mission.
And then you could add people's own household staff if they have houses. You know, I would guess maybe there's a couple of hundred. Few hundred people involved there.
He says while the impact will be noticeable, it's not huge.
The total UN involvement in the economy is around $50 million. I think the important thing is to put that into the context of the overall national economy. If you look at GDP, we had 4.1 billion GDP in Timor in 2010. So that's a pretty small percent. That's only around 1%.
Wherever the United Nations sets up a mission, it knows that one day that mission will finish. In East Timor, the UN's been preparing staff for the day they find themselves out of work.
More than 90% of our staff have taken part in this program we have called the National Staff Certification, where we've offered a number of training courses in all kinds of areas like information technology, translation, interpretation, administration, even, you know, creating small businesses. But I think in terms of our more professional staff, they will have very little problem, I think, getting employment. It's a bit more of a challenge, I think, with the lesser skilled staff. But we have been trying to upgrade their skills.
Ana Teresa Sequeira has been working with the United Nations mission for 5 years in the Public Information Office.
When I hear about my contract will end soon, I feel like a little bit sad because I don't think that I'm going to get a job soon. But fortunately, actually, I got a job as a media manager in my country, and it's really nice. I want to join them.
Do you think it will be as easy for your colleagues to find work?
I think all of my colleagues in the Communication and Public Information Office, I think that they have enough skills to find a better job after a UN mission ends.
Are there enough jobs around in Dili at the moment, or are jobs quite few and far between?
I think it's only few, and some colleagues are still looking for a job, but some already got a job.
It's not just those employed directly by the United Nations that will be affected. Gary Gray again.
It will affect specific sectors more. And obviously the restaurants around Dili, where you might see a good percentage of the people there being from the UN side, and some of the more upscale shops that sell imported goods and things like that will be disproportionately hit by this. And there will be a need, for them to kind of readjust their business strategies.
While many businesses have been preparing for this for years, some are still expecting tough times ahead. Michael McGovern, the owner of the Dili Beach Hotel, says 50% of his business comes from the United Nations.
I expect 2013 to be extremely hard. Very, very hard.
He's been hoping the tourism sector would pick up, but says high airfares from Australia make it prohibitive for travellers.
All we can do now is cut our costs, cut staff. We have a total of 36 rooms in a very big restaurant and bar, so we expect the rooms to come back probably more than 50%.
And how many local staff do you think you'll have to get rid of?
Probably initially about 20%. We've got 50 staff, but depending on what's happening, you know, when it comes to April, May next year, there could be another 15 to 20% finished then. So we may in total lose 35 to 40% staff.
United Nations peacekeepers pulled out of East Timor once before in 2005 with disastrous consequences. In 2006, the country descended into violence and the Australian military and United Nations returned. While it's not entirely certain how the local forces will cope this time, Gary Gray says he thinks the UN's departure is a good thing.
The overall picture is very positive because it the fact that we are withdrawing is an indication of the stability of the country and the fact that we've gotten through this last year very smoothly in terms of the election period that a number of people had been, you know, concerned about before as being, you know, possibly quite a risky period. And we got through that very smoothly and the situation is very calm and it's remained calm. So I think that's the big picture we have to look at.
And with that report from Stephanie March, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Again, focus@pcjmedia.com. We're going to end off today with a little music from Pakistan. The artist's name is Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan from the album Body and Soul. Until next time, friends, this is Keith Perron on behalf of the whole team. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.
ਫੁੱਲ ਮੁਰਝਾ ਗਏ ਸਾਦਕ ਰਹੀਆਂ ਬਸ ਕੰਡੀ।